Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Hour. I'm Steve Lendman. Ellen Brown is back today. Always a special program when Ellen comes on, talking about all things economic and finance. And Ellen's got a brand new article. Oh, dear. She said some nice things about quantitative easing. We'll just call it QE on this program. Oh, my goodness. I sent Ellen an email and said I wasn't quite as kind, except in the last section where we absolutely agree if the darn thing is used right. But before we jump into that, let me just mention one thing. Ellen, of course, I keep marveling over her book, Web of Debt, and I always want to mention that there's a new edition out, updated, and anybody who hasn't read Web of Debt, give yourself 10 lashes, get the book and read it. That book taught me so much. So I'm very indebted to Ellen for what she did and what she wrote. And now it's out in a brand new edition, so you can get her latest thinking updated to the, pretty much, not to the minute, takes a while before the book gets published, but it is her latest up-to-date account of just how she assesses the banking system and the way it's been broken and the way we can fix it, et cetera, and so on. But I began the program yesterday with a short segment on Haiti. I just wanted to make a few more comments that was not included in the discussion. Had a guest on live from Port-au-Prince. There is a raging cholera epidemic going on in Haiti. I don't know if there have been any U.S. TV reports on it. Maybe when it first broke out, there was something, but I think it's been, at the very least, way underplayed and for the most part pretty much ignored. In the official numbers, it's very hard compiling death and illness statistics in a country that the infrastructure overall is just so poor. But the official numbers have something like over 800 dead and over 12,000 sick with cholera. One point that I wanted to stress I don't think came out clearly yesterday was that despite heroic work by wonderful medical providers in Haiti, so much of it volunteer, and I would say in the lead, the country that absolutely gets no mention, no credit whatsoever in the U.S. media, and that's Haiti. That's Cuba. And Cuba has been in Haiti for the last dozen or more years. Hundreds of doctors, hundreds of other medical providers, including doctors they train from other countries. Somebody from the U.S. can go to Cuba and get a free medical education, free, top-rated. And the only thing they have to give back is service in poor communities. It could be in America. It could be in other countries. Well, Cuban doctors and medical providers have done heroic work for a dozen or more years in Haiti. Venezuela supplied help, medical people, as well as financial aid. And Venezuela has financed a good part of the extra work that Cuba has done, especially after the earthquake and now with this cholera epidemic. I think the real numbers of dead are far, far higher than the official 800-plus. It could be 2,000, could be 3,000. But the point that was made yesterday is that this outbreak happened in one region, And now it's spread across the entire country, including in crowded sections of Port-au-Prince, where you light a fuse and you can set a forest fire. And that's the great danger. One thing we didn't discuss yesterday and I wanted to mention today, there's an election scheduled in Haiti on the 28th of November, presidential and legislative, 2 weeks from today. Number one, there shouldn't be an election. Well, there should be an election, but how do you have an election when an earthquake destroyed the most populous part of the country? The people are living in the streets. They just had a hurricane go through. Didn't hit it directly, skirted it, but there was massive flooding. You've got all this. The last thing on people's minds is who are they going to vote for? But it gets a lot worse than that. Well, of course, you get it compounded by the cholera epidemic. But the worst part of it is the major party, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party, Fanmi Lavalas, was banned from participating. It's been banned since the U.S. Marines at gunpoint escorted him out of the country, not even telling him where they were taking him. Well, he was lucky they didn't shoot him dead. Fanmi Lavalas was banned. That's the equivalent of banning the Democrat and Republican parties in the U.S. But I would say in that case, that sounds like a pretty good idea to me. 13 other parties, I believe, were also banned. Roughly 13 or 14 parties were banned. The only parties running, the only candidates running, are the ones that Washington said can run. Now, that's called an election. Let me give you one quote that I want to mention one more thing, and we'll jump into today's program. On the 24th of September, on Voice of America, you all know what Voice of America is. That's the official world U.S. propaganda voice. Susan Rice, Obama's ambassador to the U.N., said, I quote, I have to be sure I say I quote, so there's no misunderstanding. She said, peaceful and credible elections and the transfer of power to a new government will be key milestones of Haiti's progress. The United States and the United Nations continue to help Haiti recover and rebuild. Oh, God. The U.S., along with the United Nations, is committed to staying with the Haitian people and helping them. The only thing America did after the earthquake in January was to militarize the country, obstruct aid. Afterwards, they pledged $1.1 plus or so billion dollars. How much have they delivered? Zero. Zero. Not one thin dime. And nearly all of the money that's been pledged and whatever's been donated is going for development, commercial development. Haitian people, the hell with the Haitian people. That's the real response from Washington. One more thing. Aristide is in exile in South Africa. He's been there since, they didn't take him there originally. They took him to the Central African Republic, a French affiliated country, a dictatorship. That's where he ended up back in the end of February 2004. But he eventually went to South Africa, where he's in exile. And my understanding is they're treating him very well. He's a former president. He gave an interview. He has not done much of anything on that. He's really wanted to keep his head down, but he gave an interview, and one of the questions, somebody went to South Africa and met with him, I guess where he's living. It was a rather long interview. One question asked was, can you give us your thoughts on the recent cholera epidemic? Let me just read you a little bit of that. And he said, quote, as for this incident of cholera, whether or not it was imported, as the evidence strongly suggests, it's critical. First, those who organized the coup d'etat / kidnapping of 2004, paving the way for the invaders now accused of having caused the recent outbreak of cholera, must also share the blame. The more I think about it, the more I'm convinced it absolutely was imported. And who imported it? The UN peacekeepers who were stationed in the area where it first broke out, and they're not peacekeepers, they're paramilitaries, and they're U.S. agents, and I think they deliberately infested this area, Haiti's major rice-growing area, and that's what Aristide says. Well, second, the root causes and what facilitated the deadly spread of the disease and structural embedded in Haiti's historical impoverishment, marginalization, and economic exploitation. The country's once thriving rice industry, destroyed by the subsidized U.S. rice industry that was in the area hit, the epicenter of the cholera outbreak. Anyway, he goes on and on and on, but he said some of the things that were mentioned on the program yesterday. It's good to hear from him. He wants to come back. The people desperately want him back. And if his Fanmi Levelas party were allowed to run, even with him in absentia, even if he wasn't a candidate, they could put Mickey Mouse up as the candidate for Fanmi Levelas, and Mickey Mouse would get 90% of the vote. In other words, it's anybody but the ruling class that has brutally exploited the people. Well, I'll follow the Haiti situation. I wrote twice since cholera broke out and an awful lot after the earthquake hit in January. It's a major, major topic for me. But we want to go on to other things that are important, too. The economy. quantitative easing. Ellen, your new article on quantitative easing. I agree with you 100% that if the money is used properly, it could be an elixir. The article that I sent to you saying quantitative easing, elixir or poison. Well, my fear and my belief is that the way it's being used, it's poison. But it sure could be an elixir, and that's what you talked about in your article. Explain what you wrote. And forgive me for my other point of view in most of my article. But I hope you did notice my last section where I agree with you. Anyway, your article, Ellen, welcome. Sorry for that long introduction. Talk about what you just wrote about.
Oh, no, that was very important what you said about Haiti. That was great. I'm sorry to hear that, but I don't doubt it.
You call your article QE2. It's the federal debt, stupid. Well, I agree. You continue.
Well, everyone thinks that QE2 is about bailing out the banks, just like QE1 was, but it isn't. QE2 is different. It's funding the government directly, or it's sort of indirectly, but it's definitely funding the government and nobody else. That's where the money's going to wind up. The Federal Reserve has said it would buy $600 billion in long-term government bonds. It'll buy them on the secondary market. It's not allowed to buy them directly from the government because it's, you know, considered bad form to fund your government directly through your central bank, which is like money printing. But in fact, money printing is exactly what Congress itself should be doing. If we have, say, a $1.3 trillion deficit, and actually it looks like they're going to fund the entire deficit through the Federal Reserve. But I think that's a good thing because the Federal Reserve rebates its profits after it deducts its costs. It's the only creditor that does that. So it's the best deal in town for the government. And what it does is it takes the heat off the federal government going into debt, which it has to do because the private debt system has dried up. All of our money today consists of debt or credit. It's all borrowed from banks. Well, except for this bit that the Federal Reserve is just printing outright and coins. But other than that, it's all borrowed from banks. And of course, the Federal Reserve is a bank, and you could say that the what it's printing and then lending to the government is also a debt. So it does originate as debt. But where the Fed gets it gets it just by printing it.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
How do you know this money will not go to the banks and will go to the government?
Well, because they're buying government bonds. That's the whole. They're buying $600 billion in government bonds.
Let me throw another question in. I think all along, once this apparatus got going in QE1 and all the rest, TARP and all the rest, the Fed, I know, has bought mortgage-backed securities and also U.S. Treasuries, but my understanding is they've been doing a lot of swapping by picking up the toxic debt from the big banks, Goldman's and J.P. Morgan, et cetera, and just swapping them for U.S. Treasuries. In other words, the old Aladdin story, new lamps for old or old lamps for new, when this, U.S. Treasuries for toxic debt, why might they not be doing that now?
They did swap. Well, it was the foreign creditors, the foreign central banks, who got all over the Fed for monetizing the debt. I saw one Chinese economist said, "We hope you are not planning to monetize your debt, because that has a bad name for a government to go to its central bank and just have the central bank print the money, because that sounds like it's going to inflate the system." But what they're not acknowledging, and that is exactly what they're doing, and that's what QE1 did do to some extent, but Bernanke was criticized for that. So then I think it was fall of 2009, he said, okay, the heat's off, the economy's fine, we're not going to have to do that anymore, we're not going to do any more of this money printing, and we're not going to do any more buying government bonds. But what they were going to do was to buy mortgage-backed securities, supposedly to help the housing market. But as you said, what the effect of that, and as Bill Gross said, the effect of that, because he's a bond buyer, so he knows, the Fed would buy mortgage-backed securities from Bill Gross and other bond sellers or bond dealers, and then Bill Gross would take the cash and turn right around and buy government bonds with it. So it still was a funding of government bonds, and the foreign central banks would do that as a swap. In other words, the foreign central banks would buy government bonds, the Fed would buy mortgage-backed securities, and then they would swap with the foreign central banks for the bonds. So it was, even before, 80% of the deficit was being funded through the Fed, as Bill Gross said. So that's what they're doing with QE2 more directly. But my point is, I think that's a good thing. And what they should have done, what the government should do, is just issue the money directly, $1.3 trillion, because we have a huge deflation. We have a huge collapsing of the credit system going on right now. And somebody has to be putting debt out there, or there's just no money for the operating expenses of businesses. Businesses borrow before they produce. They take out credit lines, or they do commercial paper, et cetera. Somebody's got to put up the money in order to get the businesses, to give them the financing to pay their workers so that they can build stuff, so they can sell stuff, so that we can have an economy that actually functions. And the private credit market has dried up, and therefore the public debt has to increase, and it's a good thing for it to increase. Or alternatively, better yet, would be for them to print it directly, but since they don't do it and they won't do it, then the next best thing is to let the central bank print it, and then the government borrows it from the central bank, and then the central bank rebates the interest, which means we no longer have a growing interest bill. And it's because of this interest bill that interest rates have had to be pushed to very low levels. So people are squawking and they're saying, what about the commodities, inflation in commodities abroad? But that is because of this carry trade that was set up, because they've had to push the interest rate so low in order to prevent the interest bill from the federal debt that's imposed on our income taxes, to prevent that from going up. The debt itself has gone up by 50% since 2006, more than 50%. But the interest bill hasn't gone up at all. In other words, we're saying we paid about $400 billion then, we're paying $400 billion now to fund 50% more debt, and that's because the interest rate is close, it's very, very low.
I call it free money, Ellen, except for you and me. If you and I want to go out and get a loan, we cannot go up to the Fed window and say, give me whatever, and a quarter of 1% interest, or maybe even zero, unless we have a name tag that says J.P. Morgan Chase.
Yeah, well, that's my argument for, I'm actually at a conference right now, and I just gave that lecture yesterday, that's the reason we should have publicly owned banks, because then we, the states, or whoever owns the publicly owned bank, we the public, can borrow at 0.2% instead of 4.7%, which is the average that states are paying on their bonds. Plus, states are stuck with all this stuff like they got into these interest rate swaps that were a really bad deal. Wall Street sold them on the idea that they needed to have variable interest rates, and then they protected them with these swap things. Well, it turned out that, of course, interest rates, instead of going up, wound up going way down, which meant that we were paying Wall Street instead of the reverse. So, and all the governments, the deal was they had to pay these huge sums to get out of the deal. So, like Los Angeles is one that got suckered into this thing. So if you had your own bank, your own state bank, and you had a credit line, all the little cities had a credit line with their own state bank, they don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. You can set your own interest rates. You don't have to worry about late fees. I think I saw Illinois pays 12% in late fees. I mean, this is a state paying 12% in late fees for borrowing money. Well, why not just have their own bank that issues the credit based on doing it the way all banks do? In other words, they take a lot of deposits, and then they ostensibly lend out the deposits. They don't really. We know what they do is they create new money on their books, and then they use the deposits to cover the checks when the checks go out. In other words, for the checks to clear, they have to pass through this deposit pool. So essentially what you do is you steal from the till to clear your check, and then you fill the till back up. And hopefully you can fill it up with your own depositors that walk in the door. But if you don't have enough people walking in the door, then you can tap up the Federal Reserve at their low interest rate, or you can tap up the other banks at 0.2%, really low.
Well, Ellen, you know you get a big amen from me when the topic of publicly owned state banks come up. To me, that just seems like such a simple way. If the federal government and the Federal Reserve, that isn't federal, will not do the proper thing, whether or not it's doing something proper or more proper now, the states simply does not matter to the states. They can opt out on their own. Like North Dakota, the only state in the country that's done it, they can set up their own publicly owned state bank. They can charge whatever rate of interest they want. They can loan money to whoever they want to. You and I, Ellen, if we lived in that state, or small businesses, or big businesses, or kids that want a low tuition loan to go to college, and they can grow the state prosperously just the way North Dakota has done it. And you've said it, and I've said it, if North Dakota can do it, then why can't Illinois and California do it? Why can't New York and Michigan do it? They're mm-hmm. not stupid, Ellen. They know what North Dakota is doing. Something is rotten in those states, as far as I'm concerned, to explain why they're not doing it. They moan about their crises, and they're not doing a damn thing to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Tom Hagen figured out these figures. He's somebody in my public banking Google group, and he's working on a proposal for Maine and Massachusetts for a publicly owned bank. In North Dakota, they mandate in as deposits, not just the state revenues, but all the municipal revenues, any form of government revenue in the whole state automatically goes into the Bank of North Dakota as deposits. So then you've got an equal amount of credit as you had deposits. So in North Dakota, per population, there is $4,000 per person in North Dakota in deposits in the Bank of North Dakota, amassing all these various government revenues, plus they take private depositors who want to deposit their Ken or bank their Ken. And then if you use that model and project it on California, for example, and you multiply the California population by 4,000, that means that California, the Bank of California, would have a potential $200 billion in credit that they could do with as they would. So the anticipated deficit next year for California is between $11 billion and $19 billion. So a mere 10% of your $200 billion you could use to fund your deficit. And then you could refinance your old debt, for one thing, and get rid of that 4.7% interest rate and bring it down to 0.2% or zero, whatever. And that's just the two, and then fund other things as well, like projects. You want to develop infrastructure, a high-speed train from L.A. to San Francisco, that type of thing.
So instead of doing that, Ellen, they're handing out IOUs, and they're laying people off,
mm-hmm.
and they're cutting social benefits, and
the
they're selling off public property to private investors. I think Schwarzenegger should go back to weightlifting and acting.
Well, he will soon.
He will soon. It can't happen the moment too soon, but I'm afraid that judging
Gary
him in that context, there are 48 other Schwarzeneggers in the country that are running these states just as abysmally.
Yeah,
including in my own state. And it's not going to, we just had an election, but nothing is going to change. I mean, things are going to just continue to be as bad as they have been. And sooner or later, the hammer has already come down here, but the hammer will just keep coming down and coming down and coming down. I have a dark view of things, Ellen. That's why I'm skeptical just what good QED will end up doing, because I truly believe, when I've had Catherine Austin Fitz on the program, it's been an awful long time. I hope I can get her back again before too long for another update. But former high-level insider, Assistant Secretary of Housing, and she really saw the workings of the government from the inside. And she just says that you go back to the 1990s when she saw it developing, that these powers, the big financial interests, they pulled off a financial coup d'etat. And part of it is, I mean, just sucking the wealth out of the country and wrecking the country, wrecking the economy. And, mm-hmm. and the whole process began in the 1990s, and then it exploded back at the end of 2007, 2008, and since. And the so-called recovery that we've had has been very, very meager. And the economists that I follow, like David Rosenberg, who puts out a daily report, and he says he's surprised that the economy hasn't really gotten an awful lot weaker by now, but he fully expects it to happen. He is not high on QE.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the 1930s, we've already hit the unemployment rate that they had in the 1930s, but it was much worse then because they didn't have Social Security, they didn't have unemployment insurance, they didn't have food stamps. So the reason this one is milder is because of all those things that were put into place in the 1930s, and those are the things they're trying to get rid of.
They're trying to get rid of
Social Security, which is unbelievable. It used to be that Social Security was just sort of a backup retirement fund, but now I know people, that's their whole income is Social Security.
We have to take a break. Those are important thoughts. Absolutely. Isn't that more evidence that they're trying to wreck the economy?
Yeah, they're trying. Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a break and we'll come right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Elaine Sniffa, host producer of Evolving Ideas, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Greetings, this is Ellen Kamai, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Eugene Zamperone and I have been deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combined traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN from 1 to 2 p.m. every Monday. We'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, yourselves, and your family. Tune in to Progressive Radio Network every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or anytime by visiting the archives. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Bernanke's quantitative easing program, QE2 as they call it. Maybe there'll be a QE3, well, it really kind of all blends together. Another regular guest of mine, Ellen, Bob Chapman, who publishes the International Forecaster. He also is a former insider, been around this business for 40 years or more. And he was talking about QE2 back in May. I knew he was talking about it around mid-year, and he said he broke the news in his forecaster before the media picked it up later on, and then the big announcement that came just recently. And he said that the Fed was doing QE2 back in May. And one more thing, and then you pick up with where you left off. You know, Carl Dettinger, you quote him, and I quoted him in my last QE article. And we both get an awful lot of emails, so much comes to me, including an awful lot of information. I got one during the break, and it sent me to Dettinger's market ticker, and out of curiosity, I had to take a look, so I pulled it up, and I haven't read the discussion below. It's got a YouTube as well. But the headline is from Dettinger, Bernanke's QE explained, quote, screw you, America. Well, we need to get you and Dettinger on the program together, Ellen, so you can debate him. Anyway, your comment on that, and you can pick up for where you left off.
Actually, I saw the headline too, but I didn't read it either, so I can't remark on what the substance was. I'm here at this conference, and Steve Keen is here, and he's from an Australian economist, and he said that what the federal government should do is print $1.3 trillion, and just that's how they should pay the deficit or cover the deficit, and then you don't have to worry about this carry trade and worry about. You don't have to raise taxes, et cetera. But the government won't do that. Congress absolutely will not print the money. Ken Bonsack, who is a money reformer, he actually talked to some Congress people in Washington, and he was proposing that all they would have to do was issue the money. And they said, well, you know, we're actually more comfortable borrowing it. I mean, that's their mentality, is that they want to borrow it because it looks better to borrow it, because then it looks like you're not creating money. So borrow the next best thing to the government printing money, which is the obvious way out, is to have your central bank print it, and you borrow it from the central bank, and then you have the central bank rebate the interest, because we never, ever pay off the federal debt. It just keeps growing, and it hasn't hurt us. We've been on top of the global economy for most of the last century, and meanwhile we had a federal debt that's going up exponentially. It hasn't been paid off since 1838, and whenever they do try to pay it off, I think it was Randall Ray showed the statistics on that, every time they've paid it down at all, they've actually hurt the economy, because you need that debt out there. That, I mean, when the government goes into debt, it's because they're paying somebody for something, so they're putting money out there. They're paying. I mean, of course, a lot of it's the military, and we think the obvious solution would be to stop going to war. But the reason the military is so big is that it's our largest socialist institution. I mean, the soldiers are. They've got a guaranteed job. They've got something. They've got a wasting asset that they can keep producing over and over. You know, they can keep producing ammunition and selling it off to. I mean, there's always a market for it because they create the market. But why not? We could have some sort of socialist institution that was like the military, that was for peaceful purposes. That's what the Japanese did in the late 19th century. They had all these samurai that weren't doing anything, and the government was paying the samurai. So they decided to pay them off in a lump sum, but the deal was that the samurai had to put it into a business that would then, so it was a public-private partnership sort of deal where the business would be commissioned to produce things that the government wanted. And that's where all the big businesses came from, like Mitsubishi, Mitsui, all that stuff came from. Those were samurai who were pacified. They were turned into peaceful warriors building something useful for the economy.
You know, I didn't know that, beginnings of whatever is in existence today sometimes can be very surprising. I must say, though, Ellen, there's no question that the military is, as you say, a great socialist institution in the country. Not just the soldiers that have a guaranteed job, some job, you know, you a job that you might get your head blown off, but
yeah.
maybe your survivors will get some kind of benefits. Some
right.
They'll lose you, but they'll get some kind of benefit. But it's a lot more than the soldiers, and it's a lot more than the defense contractors that get billions of dollars in contracts. It's all the other companies that profit from war. The technology industry is huge, makes huge amount of money from war. All the technological development that they produce earmarked for war making. And then maybe it will end up having some kind of a civilian use as well. The space program is the same thing. The space program isn't about Star Trek going where no one else ever went before and doing wonderful research. Well, they are doing research, but it's research related to war making, not peacemaking. And then all the other industries that profit from war making. I mean, if suddenly wars ended 100% cold turkey, they would have to find another way to spend money, or we would have, at the least, another Great Depression, even if we were healthy when they decided to do that. But at the same time, money spent for productive civilian economic growth goes a lot further than money spent for war making. You get a bigger bang for the buck, but they don't do it that way. They still want to fight wars because we have our imperial agenda, too, not just growing the economy. But we have an imperial agenda, and that's, in the end, very destructive.
Mm-hmm. Somebody said at this same conference that some economists projected that we need 50 million more farmers to have a sustainable system. Well, what if we had, instead of a military, we had a farmer's army where we had a sort of socialist system of farmers? What I'm thinking, there's also 62 million homes that are in the, held in the name of MERS. Those people might actually own their homes outright because of this whole mortgage, you know, the whole foreclosure gate thing. What if they own their homes outright, but they still owe money on the note because they signed a note? It's just, you got to figure out who it is they own the money to. So what if we had used our leverage and said, I don't know, I'm just thinking, you know, you could say, all right, we're going to forgive your debt here, but we want some of you to join our farmers' army here, and we'll kind of support you cradle to grave like we used to do with the real army.
That's a marvelous idea. And during the Great Depression, we had a farmers' army. America was a very heavily agrarian country then. There was industry, and there was finance. But there were so many farms. The farm population of the country was so much larger than it is today, and it was targeted for destruction beginning at least in the Reagan administration. So for the past 30 years, the idea being to destroy small farmers and empower agribusiness. But whatever agribusiness was back in the 1930s was certainly nothing compared to what it is today. But I agree, that would be a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen for president. We'll need you to control the Congress
Stephen
as well.
For
being
president
isn't good enough, Ellen. You got to control the Congress as well.
You can be the president. I'll be the vice president. I'll just work in the team.
Well, if you and I put in policies like this, I remember Bill Blum, who wrote, he's done some wonderful writing, been around a long time. Rogue State was one of his great books on all the CIA machinations going back to the beginning of their time and so on. And he once wrote a small piece talking about what he would do if he were president. And I don't remember the details. You know, the stuff that you and I would do, Ellen, plus all the social things. And he just enumerated, like, on day one I do this. And on day two I do this. And on day three I do this. And on day four I'd be assassinated.
Right, you better act quick.
So, and of course, if they get rid of you, then they simply undo everything that you did.
Uh-huh. Well, that's it. They're still trying to undo what Roosevelt did. That's what the...
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Roosevelt didn't do such a great job.
Well, my punchline, Ellen, is what a way to go.
Right.
I'll tell you. I mean, if I could do that for 3 or 4 days, I would say what a way to go.
I agree. That's the advantage of having lived our lives.
Absolutely. You know, living on your feet instead of dying on your knees, and boy, the country and most people in it are dying. I wouldn't say on their knees. They certainly have. They don't support what's going on, and they have nothing to do with it. But the effect of it is it literally is destroying them. That's why I feel that the policy has been literally to wreck the country, not fix it, which makes me skeptical that QE2 will now suddenly have gotten religion and not do what the Fed and the Bush and the Obama administrations should have done when this thing broke out at the end of 2007. And I must say, Ellen, it did not catch them by surprise, because they'd been engineering it all these years leading up to when it broke. And I have a feeling also that maybe the big banks like Goldman decided on the moment to pull the trigger and bring the economy down. And then maybe they decided on the moment to make it look like things were reviving. And things revived to a certain degree. And maybe again they'll decide on the moment to pull the trigger again and put things into reverse. And I honestly believe that the worst of this mess is yet to come. But we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we need, like you say, everybody's discontented, but we're not organized, and they're organized. I mean, they've got the control. So somehow we have to get organized, it seems to me. I'm here at this conference, so I'm steeped in all, what everybody's been saying. But Nicole Foss was here, and she made the comment that if you have a lot of scattered energy and you focus the energy, that's a laser beam. So now you've got the power of a laser beam. So that's what we need to do, is focus our energy somehow. And it seems to me that this foreclosure gate thing is our big opportunity, because if 62 million homeowners really can own their home free and clear, or have that potential, even legally, have that clout, you know they're going to start sweeping this under the rug. We're going to start seeing bills to say that MERS is okay and that it can it doesn't break the chain of title or something. But what you're doing is destroying 200 years of property law. We have to be aware of what's happening here and just protest loudly, and we have to be organized in some way in doing it. I'm thinking what I'm going to do is set up a website and give legal advice on how to protest this stuff. I'm a lawyer, so it's like doctors. You're more likely to get in trouble if you have a license than if you don't have a license, because there are certain things you're not allowed to do. So I wouldn't actually give legal advice, but what I could do is post pleadings that have been successful, and just point out that the way most lawyers work is they copy other people's pleadings. I mean, plagiarism is okay in the legal business. That's how you do it. So it is. And so what they should do, is go into, let's say you're paying on your mortgage, you're not actually in foreclosure, so you don't want to risk it where you just say, okay, I'm not going to pay because I don't think I have to pay. You don't want to do that, because you're liable to be put into foreclosure. But what you can do is you can go to court and move for quiet title, do a declaratory relief action for quiet title, which means that you want the court to declare, to determine whether, in fact, whoever it is who purports to be in a position to foreclose, whether they really have title, or, you know, whether they have the right to foreclose, or whether the chain of title has been broken, et cetera.
Been broken, because the actual ownership has been sliced and diced into so many pieces that, Bank A can say it's the owner and it's doing the foreclosing, but do they legally have the right to say that they can foreclose on these homes? I guess there's a good argument to say they don't have that right.
Right. My first job was I worked in the court as a clerk for three different judges, and so we were supposed to review the papers first before the judges did. And so we were told, or the guy that trained me said, our first job is to find something wrong with these papers. What we want is some technical defect, because the judges don't have time to hear this stuff, and we got to weed out all the ones that, you know, they want us to weed them out as best we can. So every little technicality that anybody screwed up on, you could bounce it on that, and you would. So here are the banks it's a total double standard. I mean, they're allowed to submit these affidavits. They're absolutely phony. There is no question. We know from all the robo-signing thing and all the depositions they're doing, these people had no idea what they were signing. They were backdating stuff. I mean, they were absolutely making a mockery of the whole affidavit system, where you declare under penalty of perjury that you know that what's in this document is true. So if they can get away with that, in other words, if there's some people that can lie on their affidavits, that means you don't know what evidence is good evidence. Well, the whole court system is based on evidence. You take your evidence and you apply the rule of law and you come out with some sort of legal conclusion, and that's what the legal system is. Well, if your evidence is no good, if some people get to submit bad evidence, but other people are held to a very tight standard, it's a kangaroo court. I mean, we can't allow that. So that's why, to me, we gotta just keep talking to make sure that people are aware that we are getting taken advantage of here, and we can't allow them to railroad this thing through. They're going to say, well, it's just a technicality, and everybody knows the homeowner owes the money, and we can't let them own the home outright. But what we'll say is, well, they're not going to own the home. I mean, they're acknowledging they owe money to somebody, but you can't foreclose on their house for that. You're going to have to go after them personally, because you do not have, you haven't complied with the law for foreclosing on real property.
Well, there's no question that is a very important initiative to pursue, Elena. The power of information, the power of repetition, and again, if enough people get angry enough about they're being ripped off, and if they realize there really is a remedy, and now somebody explained it to me, and this is how we do it, and some other lawyers maybe can get some class action stuff put together, the power of those scattered people literally can become a powerful laser, and that power, Alan, I think there's no question that power would be greater than anything Goldman and JP and the others could muster. I mean, you get millions of homeowners together saying, sorry, Charlie, no more, it's my home, and you're not getting it, and they stand down, they stand firm on their position, then you could win the day, but, creating that force is a major hurdle. It's no easy job. We don't have the big TV networks to spread the word, so we do the best we can, and we hope for the best result possible. But there are good solutions out there. People just need to know about them.
Yeah. Our job is, as Bush said, it's the propaganda. That's our job, the propaganda. We got to say it over and over and over.
Well, our propaganda happens to be the truth.
I know. Well, that's the thing. They're pumping their propaganda out there all the time, so we got to keep knocking it down.
Oh, well, we absolutely have to keep knocking it down, and of course that's what a program like this is all about. But I keep complaining that we don't reach millions of people. Just imagine the power if we did reach millions, and there were wall-to-wall programs like this, reaching people around the clock. Well, of course, these bandits never would have gotten away with what they did in the first place. They never could have pulled off a financial coup d'etat. They never could have wrecked the country, because people would be so knowledgeable about what was going on, the first smell of something bad, and the long knives would be out against these people. To think of the possibility that we really could have a government off by and for the people, instead of one that literally doesn't give a damn about the people.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing. The government's been so bad for so long that nobody trusts government at all. Like, they want to be anarchists, but government is supposed to be a thing that protects us. That's what the whole Constitution was about. It's an umbrella making sure that our rights are enforced and enforceable. That's what the court system is. It's there. The court system is obviously a government institution, and it's there to enforce our rights, not to take our rights away. So if you get rid of all these institutions, like, you know, so many money reformers want to have all these private money systems going on because they don't trust anything the government does. So somehow we have to restore the name of, you know, government of the people, by the people, for the people. That's what we're looking for. It's not government per se that's bad. It's a government that's been bought off by the mafia.
Well, absolutely right. People, when people rail against, you know, the quote on big government, the only government that's bad is bad government. Government mm-hmm. can be wonderful if it really serves all people in the country. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have never had a government like that. And it's truer today than it's ever been before. The country wasn't designed to be government of, by, and for. Well, of, by, and for sure, but not the ordinary people, the rich and powerful people. That was the original construct of this country, including in the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, which is really shocking when I discovered that the Bill of Rights really were not for ordinary people. They were for the elites in the country to be sure that their homes weren't searched and seized, mm-hmm. and that their free speech wasn't denied, and that their right to own a gun wasn't taken away. But they were talking about militias. It wasn't for you and I to have an AK-47 or a howitzer in our home because the Second Amendment gives us that right. Well, the Second Amendment does not give us that right. But they put these rights in for themselves, not ordinary people. But why shouldn't we have them, and why shouldn't we have a government representing everybody? And if we really had the right kind of a system, that's what it would be. And then it really would be democracy, in fact, not just in name. And as things are so terrible for so many people, Ellen, even with the positive economic numbers, they may not be terrific, but they're on the plus side, not the minus side. But even with those numbers, we see millions of homes being foreclosed, others in danger. We see savings wiped out. We see benefits being lost. We see jobs being lost. Your point on the unemployment rate matching the 1930s, the reason it's only 9.6 is because we refigured the way we calculate the unemployment rate. We've got these different U measurements, U3, U6. Well, you are not getting the straight result when they say the unemployment rate is 9.6. Even the U6, which includes the discouraged workers, that's 17.2, I think, the last number. But the real number is something like 22.5 or higher. Mm-hmm. Because if it were calculated the way it was in 1980, Ellen, 1980, 30 years ago, it would be a roughly 22.5%.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yep.
A sad testimony to the way people run this country. And the same with the rest of the government data. Inflation. We've refigured the inflation rate to bring it down much lower than it really is. I agree with you, though. Right now we have a serious deflation problem. But when we had an inflation problem, especially back in the 1970s, I remember so well, I think in the 1990s they really started playing with the system to literally change the calculation to get things out of a bad number to make the number look better than it really was.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say about these people, Ellen? I call these people criminals. I call the Wall Street. I don't call the Wall Street banks banks. I call them, well, the bank. I call them racketeers.
Yeah. Well, and there are some RICO cases going right now about the whole foreclosure gate thing. The big threat to them is not really the homeowners. I mean, it could be if we could get organized, but we're obviously not. It's the investors, because they're the ones that have the money, and they can. And the investors are realizing that they were taken advantage of here. Around the world, there are investor groups that lost huge amounts of money, and so they're starting to sue. They're going to have a difficult case to prove, too, but just the fact that all these lawsuits are hitting, like look at Bank of America. If the hedge funds decide to short Bank of America, which they probably are already, but the hedge funds alone or just the shorting can bring down a bank. And so I think Bank of America is going down. That's going to be the first one. So just the fact that you have all these lawsuits out there that might prevail, and they have to put a lot of money into attorney's fees, and they're having to put a lot of money into loan loss reserves for all the potential losses that they might have, is making them actually be bankrupt. I mean, their balance sheets are insolvent.
I saw a piece on Bank of America, and I can't remember from where or who did it, but it said that very thing, that Bank of America is bankrupt. They just haven't declared it yet. And I remember one number they had that they have on their books, something like $2.3 trillion in toxic debt. Well, you know, how do you buy your way out of that? And
right.
I mean, the punchline of the piece that I took a quick look at was Bank of America, as you say, is going down. And I would imagine that might have some shockwaves, because if Bank of America is in that much trouble, can the others be that healthy? I don't think the others are healthy at all.
And they will they get a bailout? That's the other issue. See, we cannot let them get another bailout. Hopefully people are so jaded with that whole concept. It's so obvious that was a mistake. Put the thing in receivership, and I would say nationalize it. I would say nationalize it for good, but I know everybody thinks nationalize means clean it up and then hand it back to the investors. But I think we'll never get out of this unless we just turn it into a public entity.
Well,
and
I have
a network of public banks.
Oh, I do agree. I wanted to raise a couple of other points, but I hear the strains in the background. it still is a mess, Ellen. I guess we'll just have to wait and see what unfolds, whether economically productive, positive policies will be instituted. Oh, one thing, let me ask you very quickly, maybe I can squeeze this in. We'll have a new Congress coming in January, the 112th. We'll have Republicans controlling the House. They're supposedly the deficit hawks. We have an agenda of austerity. Do you think there'll be an absolute positive clampdown on no more bailouts, no more handouts, no more none of this stuff? Do you think they'll stick with that?
I hope so. I mean, it seems like where are they going to get the money? If they want a bailout, they're going to have to do some serious QE2.
They sure are. Well, let's just say to be continued, Ellen. I'll shoot you an email to get you locked into coming back next month. And
okay.
Are you leaving today, or are you staying over?
Oh, I'll be here a couple more days. Yeah.
You have a close relative in that area, right?
Yeah, I did write another article on time for a new theory of money, so I have a whole different topic to discuss.
Well, absolutely, send it to me, and I'll shoot you an email fast now. And again, Ellen, it's been a riveting hour with you on.
Oh, likewise, it always is. Thank you.
Thanks, Ellen. And join us again next week, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends, 1 p.m. Who else you get programming with guests like Ellen Brown? Make it a regular habit.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.